Good afternoon. We were looking yesterday at the Trilaksana, the Trilaksana. That's the Thai version. The Pali version is Tilakana. It means the same thing. Three characteristics of all of what they call conditioned things, all things arising in dependence on a cause, which are then supported by conditions throughout their existence. Human beings, obviously, are of this kind. As is everything in the world that we would normally experience. And the first characteristic is that they all change and transform, do so continually, everything does. Obvious enough in the world, obvious enough in us, we don't need to flog it to death. It has its subtleties, it's the main insight. The Buddha called it anicca, spotting the impermanence of the human creature, the lack of a definite core or center to a human being or to anything. That life, a human being, is essentially a process, mental and physical. The thing to experience is the true nature of the mind in that sense, that it is something rather like water. It flows all the time, but it's never just one thing. It's always changing, it's always new. Every experience creates the mind that experiences it. Amazing, really. The mind is capable of experiencing this, which is even more amazing. But not once you understand how the mind really works. So all things change and transform, and this is obvious in human life. We're born, we grow old, we die. And this happens repeatedly. Every human being that's ever appeared has gone through this cycle. Everything goes through this cycle in its own way. Even things like money, which you wouldn't normally think of as being born, but is born when it's minted, you could say. Through usage, it ages, it gets old, it looks old, it gets all creased and soiled and torn if it's paper, changes its color, gets worn if it's made of some metal. Eventually, it gets withdrawn from circulation or destroyed, it dies, you could say. Everything is like this. Everything can be said to be born, to age and to die. Which is a neat way of getting into dukkha. What changes and transforms, what is anicca, what is impermanent is by its nature dukkham, dukkha. Dukkha generally refers to things which are unpleasant. The actual word itself, dukkha, if you double it, make it dukkha, dukkha, it means pain, physical pain, being the most base and obvious form of dukkha. Mental pain is dominas, it's a different word. But it's still the same kind of experience, but on a mental level. There is pain in life simply because life is a changeful process. There is disturbance in life, mental and physical. This must be. Life can be an uncomfortable process, and generally is if we really pay attention to it. Some Buddhists say that life is all dukkha. There isn't anything else. All our experiences are basically unpleasant. It just depends on how you understand that. And what they point out is that, well, there's dukkha and dukkha and dukkha. And when dukkha is strong, we call it pain or agony. But when it's very weak, we call it happiness. And you could turn that round and say, well, it's all happiness, really. It's just when it's weak, we call it dukkha, right? Yes, okay. We won't argue about it. Everybody has their own ideas, basically, what dukkha is. It's basically unpleasant. And it's natural to life to some degree, because life does change. And so you get born, which can't be pleasant, and you go through the process of growing up, which certainly has its unpleasant characteristics. You reach the age, the middle age part of life, you begin to slow down and decay, the body starts to age, and increasingly does that as you grow near to the end of life, to death. This is simply life, and all of this can be called dukkha to some degree, natural dukkha, dukkha that simply is there. Buddhadasa has some rather confusing ways of looking at dukkha. They do occur in the Pali texts, but they're rarely referred to. Dukkha as emptiness is one of the things which is rarely alluded to when people talk about dukkha, because it's very difficult to explain. Now, Buddhadasa did attempt to explain it. I don't think he ever made it very clear to anyone just what he meant. He would talk about emptiness in the form as dukkha, as being something horrible to experience, like the emptiness of the human creature, because we think it is full of a soul or a spirit or a me. When you experience it, you experience dukkha in this way. You realize that this is just an empty process, and this is an unpleasant thing to experience. And we'll get to that a little more in a moment. He talked about dukkha as being hatefully ugly. I've never seen these kind of terms anywhere else, but only in Buddhadasa's pantheon of understanding. Certainly true. If you can really understand life, you are going to find it slightly repulsive to experience after that, or at least you will find the way you lived before you realize what dukkha was truly. You will find that, you will look on that form of life as being in a way hateful and slightly disgusting, certainly ugly and gross. These forms, these kinds of dukkha are peculiar to Buddhadasa and also easy to grasp. Dukkha's pain is very obvious. And once, I remember once asking a Chinese person in Penang, where I stayed in Georgetown on several occasions as a monk, if he really knew what dukkha was. I asked him to find that out, and of course he immediately said, well, it's pain. As far as he was concerned, that was dukkha. Well, yes, it's pain, all right, but that's just one form of dukkha. Of course, everything changes. Life is unsatisfying. We can never be satisfied. We're always having to replenish our needs, to respond to our needs, because they're always coming back. You eat, but you can't just be satisfied from one meal. You drink, but you can't just be satisfied from one drink. You have to keep on doing it. Simply being alive is dukkha in the sense that we have to breathe all the time. You know, you breathe in and you feel all right, but when you breathe out, if you don't breathe back in immediately, then you come into contact with the dukkha of life immediately, because the body wants to breathe and it gives you a message. It's slightly uncomfortable, then it's very uncomfortable, and it can turn into an agonizing experience if you're not able to breathe and you really want to. Life has these forms of dukkha, has many forms of dukkha, far too many for us to go through, and it's not necessary anyway to do that. Just get a general idea across of how Buddhists understand life. Another form of dukkha comes from the changeful nature of life, in that we have to strive to get what we need to stay alive, so we have to act. If we live more naturally than we do, we'd probably spend most of our time seeking for the things that we need to sustain us, keep us alive, keep us safe, etc. This is all animals do, and we're not so different, really. Animals spend most of their time seeking out the things they need. And once they've got them, they just sit there and digest the products of their seeking. And then they start again, and they do this all the time. I suspect human beings would be a similar kind of thing, would do a similar kind of thing, would act in the same way. So we have to keep moving, keep acting, keep searching for the things that keep us alive, and that would mean traveling around quite a bit. So we come into contact sometimes with dangerous experiences because we'd be going into other people's territory, what they consider to be their territory, in much the same way that animals fight when they wander into each other's territories. Dogs do this all the time. Human beings would probably be much the same. In fact, we are. But it's not so obvious. And so on and so forth. We could go on forever. The way the Buddha expressed it, to sum it all up, he referred to usually birth, aging, sickness and death. More normally, aging, sickness and death, he would say, was dukkha. He would leave birth out, although it is included in the scriptural reference, but it might not come from the Buddha, actually. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair, so mental and physical pain, these are both dukkha. Having to be with the unloved, that which we don't like, having to do the things we don't want to do. Being separated from the loves, having to be apart from the things we enjoy doing or like being with, and wanting things and not getting them. This is life, basically. In a nutshell, all of this is dukkha, and it's dukkha quite naturally. All things have to experience it. However, the Buddha adds a tailpiece, a coda, when he says that the five aggregates afflicted or affected by clinging are dukkha. The idea being that if we cling to the functions of life, feeling, perception, thought, consciousness, and the physical form of life as being me. You think it's me, then all this stuff that we have to experience anyway during life, we can't avoid it really, is going to create another level of dukkha, which is the one the Buddha was really concerned with, because it's the one you can stop. You can put an end to all the ups and downs of life, if we think we're experiencing them, cause us to experience excessive mental disturbance. Our minds are never really still and peaceful because of that, because we believe that there is a me living life. This is the dukkha the Buddha was concerned with. It's usually referred to as suffering, although that's far too strong, really. Because we gave some examples of what this kind of dukkha really is. It can be very gentle, like the obstacles to meditation, with what they call nivarana, wandering mind. The dull, lazy, restless, drowsy mind, mind with no energy, is a form of dukkha on a very gentle level. The doubtful, confused mind, again, same thing. A little more serious is a negative frame of mind, the hateful mind. And the lustful mind is also, in its own way, another form of dukkha. These things can expand if you give them something to expand in dependence on. The wandering mind, for the confused mind, the doubtful mind, if you go on thinking about the thing you have doubts about, your mind becomes very messed up and half and confused. That's a strong form of dukkha then. It can even become angry from that kind of an experience. This is the dukkha the Buddha was concerned with. The dukkha natural to life, all things experience. Even stones. Although you can't say a stone experiences dukkha with any certainty, but you can certainly say a stone is productive of dukkha. That is, it can be a base for dukkha. If we have some particular attachment to a stone, for instance, which you might think impossible, but think about it, because I use stones to keep the doors open, and if some bozo comes along and moves them, uses them for some other purpose, I might get quite angry about that. Where's my stone? There you are, you see, that can be productive of dukkha if you misunderstand it and respond to it unwisely. That's dukkha, and it's dependent in the case of suffering, which is what we should be most concerned with, rather than the other dukkha. It's dependent on the misunderstanding of the human state, which the Buddhist claim is peculiar to us, or largely peculiar to us, in that we think that the body and mind is me. If we cling to any part of the five aggregates, this is basically what will happen. The feeling of being me will arise from what they call clinging. I won't bother to explain that now because we'll look at it in some detail, probably tomorrow, how that happens. It supports the illusion there is a me because we're constantly desiring things. And as all things, really, all the physical things we experience, they're part of the rupa kanda, they're part of the aggregates. And we're continually seeking, chasing after, trying to acquire, and therefore clinging to different elements of nature, all of which belong to the aggregates. So when we cling to the aggregates, this is one of the ways we will do it. We will cling to things that we want to get, cling to things that we want to acquire, cling to things that we want to get rid of. And it's this kind of mental activity, the kind of taking hold, of sticking to something, as being a possession mainly, is what creates the feeling of me in the human mind. If that happens, and it does all the time with us, if it happens continually, which it does with us, it becomes an habit, and then we just fall into accepting that this is me, and that there is always a me here. This me was born, it's going to live life, it will be the same me, and it will be the same me that eventually has to face up to death, and possibly after death go on into some other form of existence. All human beings seem to have this kind of understanding, not necessarily that they will be reborn, but that there is a me living life. And it comes from the fact that as babies in the womb, as a fetus in the womb, we're not endowed with knowledge. We don't have any knowledge. We don't know anything much. In fact, we don't know anything. We don't need to, because everything is automatic. Child in the womb is not thinking, is not reasoning, is not imagining, doesn't need to. That will come later when it's born into the world. This is the Buddhist take on pre-birth. And when we come into the world, we're in the same state. We have no knowledge. We don't really even understand ourselves. Why should we? We don't know what we are. We have no idea. There's no reason why we should. We don't know how we should behave, what we should do as a living creature. Nothing does. Neither animals, nor human beings, nor anything else that gets born. We have to learn these things. And unfortunately, we don't generally get taught the sort of things we should be taught, say the Buddhists. We get educated, yes, but not in a way which is really, which would be beneficial for us in the ultimate sense. So, brings us into contact with the third of the characteristics of Trilaksana. The third one is anatta. Anatta has the meaning of not self. And in old former times it was translated as not soul or not spirit, which sounds really awful. Not self is not very English, but it will have to do. They say that because they don't want to say no self. As that would be going further than what the Buddha actually said. And he never said no. He always said, well, never said not either. What he said was an, which you have to assume can mean not, or it can also mean no. But if you say there's no self, then this is a denial that if you get rid of the feeling of being me, which is the cause of all our problems, and then you will be some kind of robot. There wouldn't be anything left behind which was selfish. This is obviously not the case, so the Buddha would have said no self. He would have used the term like niratta rather than anatta. Ni referring to a complete extinction, hence nirvana, complete extinction. All the problems of life are finished, gone, there's nothing left. But you can't say that about the self. That is not the case, because if there was nothing selfish about a human being at all, it simply wouldn't survive. Survival instinct has selfishness as part of its makeup. This is what keeps us alive. So the word anatta then falls into the middle, as is always the case with Buddhism. Not the two extremes. There's not anything here you could call a permanent self, they say. But on the other hand, it's not that there's nothing here. What there is something which is selfish, but is not a self. So they use the term anatta. That's another one of Buddhadasa's efforts at English. It's a self that's not a self, says he, which is rather confusing. Until you start to poke it a little bit, then it becomes a bit more understandable. Human creatures are clever. At least that's what we think, and I suppose we are. We certainly have greater abilities than most animals. Some say animals of certain kinds have greater abilities than us, but that may be the case, but I suspect it's not. And they point out dolphins because they have large brains. That doesn't mean they're clever, it just means they've got large brains. Elephants got a large brain, but it's not too bright. Certainly can't work out E equals MC squared, or explain Pythagorean equations, or any of that stuff, which is so necessary for us, and so necessary for life to continue. Elephants just know how they should function. And why they have a large brain is part of the deal. They're big, so they have a large brain. Human beings don't have a large brain, but it's large enough. I think that we're probably better equipped mentally than anything else on this planet. And the reason I say that is A, because Buddhadasa said it, and B, because it's probably true from my investigations. And therefore we have the ability to imagine in a way that animals perhaps don't. I was around dogs a lot in my life, because a pal of mine had a couple of pedigree dogs, a couple of gun dogs. And these are eccentric in the extreme. You get the impression sometimes that they are more than just dogs. They really aren't just a human being projecting its own self-belief around. We tend to do that because we think this is me. We tend to project that meaning to everything else we meet with. So dogs tend to take on a personality for us, which they really don't have. I used to watch them and I got the impression that they're not very bright. They're not clever. I used to throw things, but I mean, gun dogs, you don't throw balls for them really, but they will chase them a little disdainfully, being aristocratic, but they will do it with a kind of bored look on their face. I used to throw it, and the dog would run in the opposite direction, because it's a gun dog. It kind of follows its instincts immediately, so if something moves, it moves after it. But if your arm goes back first, then the dog runs that way, the ball goes that way. So they're very eccentric, and you kind of tend to think, therefore, that there's something more there than a dog. You know, it's just an animal like any other. I always got the impression of small children, very small children from those dogs. As they grow into maturity and old age, they never got beyond the level, intelligence level of a very small child. And what's more, they didn't have the capability to go beyond that, whereas of course children do. So I assumed that that meant that they probably were incapable of sustaining the illusion that this was them. I think they could make that illusion in their minds. They could make it momentarily or for a short time. Now, as Buddhists say, that what creates the feeling of me in the human mind is being stimulated unnecessarily. That is, being delighted or excited by an experience, which is something we chase all the time. Hence, we always have the feeling of self. It becomes a habit with us because we're always creating it. Dogs can be excited in the same way if you give them things they really like. And they're not so different from human beings. You give them chocolate and they really will go crazy for it. But they don't seem to retain the memory of it in the way we do. You know, fix on it in the same way. So it's possible they can create a feeling of me from experiencing a packet of crisps, for instance, which those gun dogs particularly like, or a bar of chocolate, if you're unwise enough to give them that kind of thing. But they don't seem to fix on it and to look for it. Once it's gone, it's gone. They just go snuffling around the way they normally would. But the way they respond to that kind of thing certainly gives the impression that they have created something a little bit different in their minds, that they do have some kind of ego sense just for a while. Because they will also argue a little bit more fiercely over such things than they would over normal food. Well, they probably can, all animals, to a certain, whatever degree, seem capable of doing this, but only momentarily, only for a short period. They're not capable of retaining the memory that this is me, that they don't fall into the habit in the same way we do. Some people think monkeys can perhaps do this, but I live with monkeys. They're all around me most of the time. They're just animals. There's nothing different about them, apart from they're extremely agile. They're extremely destructive, that's for sure. But they're meant to be. That's one of the reasons they're alive. They break the weak parts off trees and therefore keep nature healthy. They also do their business all over the place, usually on my toilet, on the front of my toilet, which is not too pleasant a thing to meet with. Monkey shit being not very nice smelling. I'm not too happy about that. I haven't managed to hit one with my shotgun yet, but I will. If I put my glasses on, I better see what I'm shooting at. I'm joking, of course. I don't have a shotgun, I use a catapult. And monkeys certainly give the impression sometimes of being very bright, and they can be taught to do basic things, like they can be taught to climb trees, throw coconuts down, and you see this a lot around this area, you did in the days of the coconut plantations, most of which these days have been replaced by palm oil plantations. And some people think you can teach them to do perhaps even more elevated things than that. I think it's possible you can teach monkeys to do very basic menial tasks, you know, like bringing things for you. You can teach dogs to bring newspapers, and sometimes you used to see this in England, some dog mincing along the road with a Sunday newspaper in its jaws, or the ignominy of it. I mean, it's an animal, you know, it's supposed to be doing what animals do, not fetching a newspaper for some character. So it seemed to me anyway that human beings endowed with a higher level of mental function. We have the same basic mental functions as animals do, but we have them on a higher level, a more ability to perceive in more detailed and complex ways. Certainly we can think in active ways that animals cannot or don't seem to be able to. We can formulate speech, therefore. Dogs do the same thing with their barking, monkeys with their kind of chirruping noise that they make. It's a form of communication, but it's not very advanced. It's not articulated in the same way that human speech is, for instance. I mean, the fact that we do so many crazy things, like build things and go to the moon, we can work out amazing equations predicting certain things, certain orbital flights and stuff like this. We can create incredible machinery. Computers are quite amazing things. And these are all sort of aberrations, things that human beings really shouldn't be involved with at all. But they do indicate that we are a very superior kind of creature to the rest of whatever's on this planet. And because of that, it's considered that we're perfectly capable also of taking something like the survival instinct, which is basically selfish. Selfish in a very basic way. All things have it, not just human beings do. But it's only the human creature with its advanced capabilities that is capable of misunderstanding that and then imagining it into something which it never is, like a soul or a spirit or a self or an ego. And this is probably where the self-sense comes from, that survival feeling, because it is selfish. And there's a very basic level of selfishness inherent in the human creature. But it's not a me. That's the point Buddhadasa was making when he said it's a self that's not really a self at all. We don't see it that way because we're not taught that this is not the case. Nobody tells us what we are. Nobody tells us that we don't really have a permanent abiding essence. There's no soul, no spirit, no self of a permanent nature in you, my dear. You're just a process of nature. Okay, you have a survival instinct like all things do, but that's all you've got. And we don't get told that. And if we did get told it while we were still in the womb, it wouldn't be a lot of use. And if we got told it for small babies, it wouldn't be much use because we'd be incapable of understanding such a thing. It's possible that when we got to the age of maybe 10 or 11 or 8 or 9, children are quick to learn. If you can teach them in the right way so it doesn't bore them stiff, they could get interested in such things because it's not that difficult really to explain if it's explained in straight, plain language. You couldn't really stop a child from falling into self-belief because it just would happen from a lack of knowledge of birth. But you could maybe address the situation a little later on when the infant was old enough that would depend. And education would be hopeless for that though, because he just lumps everybody into the same group and they all get taught the same things. There's no real grading system that goes on in education. So we start with self-belief. You can trace its origins to some extent, and we got into the habit also of doing this during these retreats. Where the human creature goes wrong is probably very early in its life, because as just mentioned, it's the normal Buddhist understanding that the child does not have knowledge while it's still in the womb. But once it comes into the world, once it's born from the mother's womb and starts to actually live in a full way, that is, it begins to experience through all its sense organs, it's only really then that the Buddhists would admit that the child is fully alive. Until that point, it's not really alive in the true sense, because in the womb it will not, for instance, be seeing anything, so that the organ of sense will not be operating. It will probably be capable of hearing, although very indistinctly, one imagines. I don't know what the inside of someone else's body sounds like, but it's probably quite loud. It will certainly feel, but it will not use its organ of taste either, because it will be fed through the umbilicus in the abdominal, the umbilical cord, will be feeding the infant. So it's not operating fully, it's not working through all the senses. Whether the mind is operational is debatable. I suppose it must be to some degree. There must be some low level of perception going on and some low level of thought, but it will be instinctual, one imagines. No active thinking in the normal sense. So it's usually assumed by the Buddhists that it's when the child actually begins to receive sense experience on all its sense surfaces, when it sees or not sees, that it keeps its eyes closed initially. But it does hear and it certainly feels, smells and tastes, because it's going to be fed almost immediately. And it's going to feel very quickly, because being squeezed out of your mother's body, if you ever watched a woman giving birth, this is hard work. And it's hard for the mother, it's pretty hard for the child too. It's kind of forced out, because if it doesn't want to come out, and then a little head appears, hopefully head first. Sometimes they come out the wrong way around, which is a bit dangerous. It comes out into the world in an operating theater. I didn't have that experience. I was born in a home, in the family bed. I can't remember anything about it. It didn't make any difference to me. But when I was born, I would have begun to experience as a human being. Until then, I hadn't been. And it's the same if you're born in a hospital, come out in a theater delivery room, into the world. You're immediately going to feel, obviously, straight away, the temperature is going to be different, and you're going to get smacked around your backside by some great big alien with rubber gloves and a white mask. That's going to really, unfortunately, got their eyes closed, otherwise they'd freak out. What is this? Well, we'd really be full of imbeciles. So you feel immediately. You smell, of course, a sharp antiseptic smell that is always around in a hospital. To a little infant whose senses are working for the first time, this must be a really quite disturbing thing. Bright lights, you know, being handled, not roughly, everybody cares for babies, but when you're delivering them all the time, you must become quite skillful at moving them around and perhaps you know, not quite so gentle because of that. Nobody wants to hurt a little baby, I'm sure. But you must get a bit blasé if you're handling them all the time. Little miracles that they are. And they get shipped off to someone, put in a cot with a load of other little squalling infants, and eventually you meet the mama. And that is where things start to go wrong. Yeah, this is nasty. And the origins of selfishness, Buddha Dasa worked quite a lot on this, and his findings somewhat controversial, I think, caused a few problems already. I'd like to give you this stuff, because I find it interesting, and it's peculiar to someone like Buddha Dasa. No Buddhist monk ever seemed to think like him. He's very interesting in this way. It's certainly the Buddha who makes the point that it's delighting things, finding delight in experience, is what creates the self-sense. Probably from the survival instinct, or don't cling too tightly to that. That doesn't come from the Buddha, although it's generally accepted that's probably what it is. It is the cause of the full feeling of ego and misunderstanding of the survival instinct. But you can trace it, and it's when mama begins to deal with a little baby. In fact, both parents can be blamed to some extent for the fact that we get saddled with selfishness and then a lot of problems in our lives. It's a delicate situation, a delicate thing to explain. Now remember, Buddha Dasa said this, not me. I'm just repeating it. So don't get tough with me. Unless you're really beautiful and easily managed. It goes something like this. The idea is delight is the root of selfishness, is the root of the belief that there is a me. Because if we experience something delightful, and babies are capable of being delighted, as are any animal, as is any creature, if a baby is delighted, then it's going to feel delight towards the desire towards the delight. That is, it should feel desire towards the food for what it needs to keep it alive. But when the baby is being fed, if the experience is made into a delightful one, then it's going to feel delight, desire towards the delight rather than towards the food which it needs to keep it alive. So when the little infant is being fed, the idea is, and if mama makes a fuss of it, as mamas tend to do, and jiggles it around, talks to it, and tries to make it chuckle and wave its little arms around, and then that is probably what is going to cause that child problems for the rest of its life, or at least it will be the beginnings of the problem. Because mama will really be doing something which is not necessary. Now this sounds very kind of harsh, but it's probably true. You watch animals, they don't do things like this at all. Yet they look after their children perfectly. You watch monkeys, this is one thing that's really interesting. Mama always has a little one underneath on her belly and it hangs on to her. And she jumps through the trees and a tiny little monkey about this big hanging on underneath. And it wants to play because there's a family of monkeys here. And the little ones, the young ones and the bigger young ones, they run around, they tumble, they play, they have a great time. And the little one wants to go and do it too. But it's too small, it will get hurt. So when it tries to run away, mama grabs it. And she just pulls it back. She doesn't do anything. She doesn't tickle it or talk to it. She just stops it from doing that. She's a very good mother. And when she feeds it, she's not... In fact, she doesn't seem to talk to it at all or do anything to it, which she doesn't need to. She just does what's necessary to give that baby life, to make it strong, to bring it up in the way so it can survive in a society of monkeys, in a hostile world. But we don't do that with our children. My mother had quite a few. She loved babies. Everybody does. How can you avoid it? And I used to help her because it was a big family. And the last pair she had were twin boys. I took great delight in, especially the little one, David. He was smaller. One was 7 pounds, one was 6 pounds when he was born. So I naturally took a liking for the smaller one because he looked a lot like me when I was young, actually. And I used to always try. I never just fed him or cleaned him up or gave him a bath. I was always messing around with him, trying to make him laugh. Because, of course, that makes me feel good when I do that. I feel happy when he feels happy. And so I used to do a lot of things to that child which he really didn't need to do. All I needed to do was the necessary, and all mother needed to do was the necessary also. But she never did that. She was always playing with the children, talking to them, tickling them, making them chuckle, making them giggle. She was very happy when they did that, as we all were. She was delighting that child, you see. So the child kind of clung to that, desired the delight, sought after the delight. That was what it looked forward to. And so feeding times for that child, well, it needed the food, But that was not what he looked forward to. It was all the others, all the ancillaries, all the unnecessary things that it got also that it probably looked forward to. And it was these experiences, because it delighted in them, it desired to experience the delight more and more, that desire is what creates the feeling of need in the human mind, say the Buddhists. And from my experiments with this over the years, this is true. And so this is posited by Buddhadasa as probably being the origins of selfishness, which afterwards is going to plague us right throughout our lives, is going to be the cause of all our problems, basically, the feeling that this is me. It starts with the feeding process, possibly, and the unnecessary things that go on during the course of that. And then the child is increasingly made a fuss of, all children are. And they're made a fuss of in a way which is unwise, says our man. We give children all sorts of things to make them chuckle, to make them delighted. You think about the big days in England, for instance, in Western Europe, Eastern Europe to some extent these days, and certainly in Eastern Asia, Eastern West Asia, Christmas has become an event that everybody seems to want a piece of. And what do we do with children at Christmas? And we load them up with presents. We do the same on birthdays. We give them lots of things, none of which are really necessary. Some are, of course, but the majority aren't. They're playthings. They're things that delight the childish mind. We give them toys, we give them dollies to play with. We watch animals, they don't do any of this. We watch cats also, which we've also done a fair bit of. It's very instructive to watch how mama treats a little cat. Cats are very playful, the little ones. Mama's not playful. And little cat, I watched in the Krishna place years ago, stayed with them years ago. They had a stray cat, which didn't have a mother. But there was another cat there whose babies had died for some reason. And she adopted this stray cat, little stray kitten. And she fed it and it started to change from being pretty ugly looking, dirty and messy, into a very fresh and healthy looking little cat. It was very playful. He used to climb onto a stool and jump on her back when she was walking past. And she would just shake it off and then put a paw on it to stop it from doing anything else. She didn't indulge its playfulness. She just, when it got too playful, just put her arm over it. And so it couldn't move. It would have to stay in one place. Cats know very well how to bring their children up, and seeing human beings aren't very good at it. It's not just mama, of course, although she would start the ball rolling. It would be papa too, because we're just as fond of children as the women folk are. And we'll indulge them all we can for the same reason. It makes us feel good. When they're happy, we feel happy. We do all sorts of other things as they grow up, of course, through the course of their education. If they have any physical prowess, we tend to encourage this, perhaps in overzealous ways, because it makes us feel good if they succeed in a field that makes us proud of them. It would be horrible, really, but it's all productive in the same way of the ego sense. It strengthens it, sets it in place, and once the child has it, beyond a certain point in its life, it's going to have self-belief until the day it dies, usually. Unless it does something about it, and because it has that, it will have a pile of unnecessary dukkha, unnecessary mental disturbance, all of which it really doesn't need to have, or it could be avoided to a large extent, if the parents had proper knowledge and were able to impart it to their children at the right time in the right way. Sounds fairly harsh, I know, to blame mother, but she is the most important thing in a child's life, and you have to admit this. I mean, it's always mama we go to, we never go to papa. It's always mama, she's always the one we want. If any problem arises in our lives when we're small, it's always our mother we'll run to. If there's any danger, it's mother we'll cry for. She's the one, she's the most important thing. But she has lack of knowledge like the rest of us. Mothers aren't wise in this way. They do what they do out of kindness. It's misguided, so says our man, and I suppose he's right. Horrible though it sounds. The child would be better off if it didn't have all that bestowed upon it. He also talks a lot about the presents and things that we load children up with, the toys we buy them, all for the same basic reason. We like them to be happy, but in a delighted sense. And of course they take delight in the gifts that we give them, the things that we give them to play with, the things that we give them as they grow. Dolls with girls, all sorts of toys with boys, all sorts of weird things we get given, all of which are very delightful to receive and to play with and to be delighted by, all of which are productive because they produce delight, are productive of the wrong kind of desire, the sort of desire that is not for what we need to stay alive, but for what stimulates and delights us. And so the consumer system grows out of that, of course. You can blame Mama for the consumer system too. Well, that's really going a bit too far. Actually, it's more reasonable to do that. I don't know what you think about that, but it's, you know, I think it's worth repeating because it seems to me it's probably right. I can't really know for sure because I'm not 100% certain that the baby can't find delight of its own account. The baby itself can't simply be delighted. It can think and it can imagine, even as a small child. And while it's being fed, okay, mother's milk is not re-stimulating, as far as I'm aware. The Indian lady told me once that it was really quite ordinary stuff. She said, what stimulates is the artificial milk that you give children. It's quite possible that the child can be stimulated by the artificial milk without mama bothering doing anything. But even so, it seems a fairly strong bet that she's mainly responsible for the child falling into self-belief simply by behaving to the child as she does. And we're all just as guilty, all of us who've dealt with children, but we had the same treatment when we were small. There's an English poet, well there was, he's dead now. I can't remember his name, unfortunately. He wrote a very famous poem. It has a strong F word in it several times. He uses that word quite often. And he calls it, they F you up, your mum and dad. You know what I mean? You know what I mean by F? I'm not going to say it. how can I put it? Yeah, you know what I mean. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with all the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were effed up in their turn. By their parents, by fools in old star hats and coats who half the time were soppy stout and half at one another's throats. And he finishes up by saying, man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. How true. Get out as quickly as you can and don't have any kids yourself because you'll mess them up. So it's not just Buddhadasa, this poet lived before, or he's a Buddhadasa's generation, but not a Buddhist by any stretch. He's a great Buddha, obviously, like most poets are, kind of like the ladies, as most of us do, but he was a bit of a boy. And that was a poet, but he says much the same thing. So a poet with a very incisive mind. I think most of us would not think this way, we don't look on our parents in this way. It's curious that Buddhadasa should come out with this and say it to Thai people, because one of the great things in Thailand is the family unit, of course, it's very close. If you get to know any Thai people, Thai families, you'll recognize that it's not just one family. Usually they have different members from different branches of the same kind of family staying in the same house. And sometimes you think the two children are the sons and daughters of a certain woman, when you find out later that they aren't. They're part of the same extended family, but they're not the son and daughter of the woman you thought they were. She has her own children, and you eventually discover that. Thai family is a very close family unit, is large and close-knit. And of course, one of the things in the Thai approach to the Buddha's teaching is that we should be grateful to our parents for what they do for us. It's kind of curious that Buddhadasa should have said what he did, given that. But you see, he did a lot of these things. He's not afraid to go against the grain of the normal teaching of Buddhism. He did the same with rebirth, which caused quite a few roar. And I should imagine this kind of thing caused a few people to take a deep breath when he talked about it. Thais would have found this pretty hard to take, I imagine. But if you think about it, there's an element about it which is probably true. And if you observe children in Thailand, they are indulged in a way which, well, I suppose we all are to some extent, but it seems to be far worse in Thailand than it was in my youth in England, although I was certainly mollycoddled to a certain extent. I wasn't spoiled the way Thai kids are. That, says our man, and I think he's probably right, is the origin of selfishness. It's delighting children, encouraging them to find delight in experience. Because then it will be the delight that they will seek rather than that which they need to keep them alive. So you can give them food, but you won't tend to give them food that just keeps them alive, which is good for them, 100%. We tend to give them canned food beyond a certain point, or some kind of artificial concoction. Once they're off the breast, you can't suckle at your mother's breast forever. You go on to a different kind of food. My little brothers and the little girl and boy who came before them, were fed with Calvin Gate. It's a canned sort of old range of purees. It's not solid, it's like crushed apple, it looks like. But it tastes very good. I think the flavors are definitely artificial, so they are chemically inspired. They're designed to delight the child, to make it want to eat, obviously, and that they do delight in them. I used to watch them being fed, the little boys particularly. They have to learn everything, they have to learn to feed, and it's extremely comical to watch. I mean, Mama feeds them for a while, and I used to feed them too, but not from the breast, with a bottle. But after a while, of course, they need solid food. So you sit them in a high chair, and the two little guys would sit next to each other, about 8 months old or whatever it was, with a bib on and a little hat. And they would be given a bowl of this mush to eat. Now, first thing that happens, the bowl gets turned over, so it just goes all over the place. And then they cram some of it roughly in their mouths. Most of it goes around their face. And they throw it around generally, but they manage to get some of it inside them. And from this process, they somehow learn to eat, learn to feed. And it's very comical to watch. But you see, that stuff is delightful. It is delicious to eat. I thought it was really tasty when I tried it. So I can imagine the child would certainly enjoy eating that stuff and would develop a desire towards it. So it would look forward to its feeding times, not for what it needed to keep it alive, but for that which was going to make it stimulated and make it chop jai, make it have a nice delighted mind, a pleased mind. And it's that kind of thing, unfortunately, say the Buddhists. It's what causes the self-sense to grow up in the mind. So that's where it starts. You might think about that. Ladies? Not much, huh? I remember where it comes from. Last month I got it in the neck. Some female who thought I was being particularly nasty. Ah, well. You know, Buddhism is not a feel-good philosophy. You must remember this. It's about bringing people into contact with reality, and reality is not about feeling good, it's about doing our duty as human beings, not running around chasing delightful experiences all the time, but actually facing up to life as it is and understanding it and doing something about it. The Buddha was a tough guy. He didn't want to make people feel happy, that was not what he was around for. He wanted to show them life. This is life, not this, this. Look at it. Understand it. If it's painful, unpleasant, do something about it, because you can. Here's how you do it. Practice is called anapanasati. Develop your mindfulness. Keep your mind still, keep your mind silent and peaceful when you experience things, and you won't create the ego sense. You don't create the ego sense, you won't have the mental disturbance. Simple. This is why they give you the food reflection, of course. Pay attention to that, because then the idea is that you watch the process of eating instead of just enjoying the food. You enjoy the food, you delight in it, you create the you who's eating the food. And then you get the problems of life, you strengthen the feeling of me. You also create and strengthen strong underground habits, strong subconscious habits that become stronger every time you indulge in these kind of things. And it all seems to start right at the beginning of our lives when we're being fed and mollycoddled and played around with by our parents. The self-sense, when it arises the first time, maybe from the feeding process this will happen. The child is feeling delight and desiring to experience more of the delight, to continue being delighted. And that will cause a feeling of self to appear in its mind, which up until that time in its life, let's say, has not done. So the child is being free of this curse, but it won't really understand it or know what it is. It will just feel a little different when it's eating, that's all. But that feeling of self won't stick around for very long. It's an ephemeral thing. It comes and goes. It's never a reality, and it never endures. There is no me who lives life right from beginning to end. There's just a mistaken understanding that there's a me who lives life. But the Buddhists say the mistaken thought does arise and pass away continually, anytime you experience anything that you find delight in. And what is the world full of? Those kind of experiences. And so our self-sense is always being sustained and strengthened by our experiences in the modern world. But when it first happens, it will happen once, and it will pass away completely. Of course, the human mind that experiences the feeding process will be created by the feeding process. And that will only last as long as the feeding process is going on. So the mind will disappear, so of course, the self-sense will disappear also. And maybe for a small baby, it won't be delighted so often during the course of the day. Mama will play with it and prod it around, and then it will nod off to sleep eventually. The fun and games is over, so any sense of self will disappear then. The child will sleep, and during the course of the day, a little baby won't create too many ego senses. It will be a babyish ego, mind you, not a big screaming sort of ego state that you often see in actors and politicians, for instance. It will be a very babyish ego state, but it will be there. But it will disappear, and during the course of a day, whenever it experiences a stimulating experience, it will create another ego sense. But it won't be the same ego, it will always be a brand new feeling of need. This is the idea. So the self-sense comes and goes, and it's the same throughout life, say the Buddhists. It never is a reality, it's just a thought that comes into the mind and lasts as long as a certain kind of experience lasts, because it's the experience that sustains it. But in that child's little mind, if it is little, at the beginning of its life, the first time it experiences a delightful experience and develops a feeling of me independence on it, then that feeling of me will disappear when the experience disappears. Go completely, but something won't. And this is where those defilements, those root defilements, I think we mentioned a couple of days ago, greed, aversion and delusion, which is where the obstacles to meditation come from. This is where these start to develop in the subconscious stream. Something stays behind once that ego sense disappears, once that mind state disappears. It's like something which is brand new, the child's mind, at the beginning of its life. There are no marks on it, no stains, it's like a brand new piece of white cloth. And the first time it feels me, and that me fades away, something doesn't, leaves a little stain on that white cloth. And that stain is threefold. That stain is greed, aversion, and delusion. This is where the root defilements begin to build. Then every time that child falls into delight and creates another sense of self, another little stain will appear on that cloth. And so the cloth will gradually cease to be a white cloth and become a completely multicolored cloth, eventually a black cloth, probably. Because with us, we're continually creating the self-sense because we're never careful in the way we respond to life. And right from our tiniest times, right until the time we die, we do this generally. So our mind becomes very defiled, or soiled, as they say, becomes very, Buddhadasa used to say, very dirty, because he was Thai. They have very dirty minds, he said. Thai word for dirt, or dirty, is sokaprok, man. Sokaprok. It's a good word there. Very awkward, very brutal, very Thai. So you get a dirty mind, but it's a subconscious mind, you see. Now the problem is that these things, they're habit patterns. The defilements are basically what create our habit patterns, what support our habit patterns. We all live habitually, but the main habit, the one that we're mostly unaware of, is to behave in the same old ways that we've always behaved in. That is, we'll seek stimulation rather than just being satisfied with what we need. We will always look for something that delights, stimulates, or excites, and the things that will make us do that will be greed, aversion, and delusion. They will enter the conscious levels with any experience. When you experience anything beyond a certain point in your life, the mind is going to respond to the experience. So if you see something which is pretty, which can create desire in the mind, then when you see it, the mind will open up to take the experience in, to deal with it and respond to it, and then the subconscious forces will also come in. Greed, aversion, and delusion will also come in. And they will cause you to misunderstand the experience, to understand it in the wrong way as something delightful, and to respond to it in the same way that you've been responding to such things, with desire, with wanting to get and to enjoy. So you have no choice beyond a certain point. Nobody quite knows when that point is. The Buddha seems to indicate that it's going to happen quite early in life. I mean, it does become scriptural. When you get into this area, the Buddha does deal with this. He generally doesn't speculate on just when selfishness first arises. It's very much a commentarial thing, but an interesting one, I think. He does make the point that the self-sense will settle down in the child's mind, will become a permanent entity for it. Around about the time it's playing with toys. Which is when these defilements, I assume, will become powerful enough to just keep that child always responding to life in the same way. and therefore always creating the me sense, from which point it must be a habit for that infant to feel me. That this is me. That's it. It's there for the rest of its life, the feeling that this is me. It will still come and go, but the infant will no longer, well, it won't know that anyway, but it would have no chance of knowing it now. It will just accept that it is a permanent entity called me, or maybe it's a soul or a spirit somewhere in here or around here or whatever. Some existent thing which is somehow eternal in some sense, and will go on from life to life to life to life to life from me. That's what it turns into. Philosophers turn it into that. But it's delight that causes this in the first place, and Buddhadasa blames mama, really blames the parents, he's a bit more reasonable than that, although he does rather focus on the mother. She delights the child, she gives it something the baby does not need, the child therefore falls in love with something it doesn't need, it finds delight and it falls in love with delight, it then seeks the delight and it will do that for the rest of its life, unless we can somehow wake the child up to this problem. Tanachan was not a fool, he also dealt with this. He said, if you can, at least, you don't want to deny children these things, because every child gets the things that delight it. Like Christmas, you don't want your kids to be, you know, forlorn and very unhappy, because there's no Christmas tree, no decorations, no bright lights, no Christmas feeling, no presents. That would be horrible. Nobody could do that. Okay, you give the children these things, and when they're old enough, you still give them these things, but you explain to them, look, these things that you take delight in, you need to understand what they do to you, and this is what they do to you. And if you explain it in a sensible way, in a way which is in plain language and not obviously religious, the child will listen and maybe can understand and maybe will want to do something about it at a young age. Because it's quite possible for children to overcome this problem, I suspect, very easily. Once you get into your puberty, beyond puberty, you start to take on the means of being alive. You have to function in the world according to your own desires and lights. You have to bring up a family, create a partnership, all the rest of it. Become a responsible human being. It's different. It's very difficult then for us to do anything about this problem. But children, well, before they take on that kind of responsibility, they have a great chance. They can overcome the problem of selfishness. They can learn to control it. Children could be encouraged to do this and would take an interest if it was put to them in the right way. I was taught religion at school. In those days in England, they used to include it in the curriculum. It was laughable, and that's all we did. Laugh at it, and take the mickey out of the teacher, because he was some pale, thin, greasy-looking individual who walked around the Bible all the time. He was asking for it, and he got it. I learned nothing about religion, except that the pages of the Bible were useful for rolling up cigarettes. That's all the religion I got from being taught. It doesn't have to be like that, you know. You can make it interesting. It can be interesting if it's taught properly and if it's profound enough to interest people. If it's a lot of goody-goody stuff, it turned me off straight away. What about you? Anyway, this is something of anatta we looked at. The origins of selfishness, it's a mistake. Remember, the truth according to Buddhists is anatta, not atta. We turn an atta into atta by believing that there is a me, an atta, here. This is me, this is the atta. A permanent, abiding entity called me. Or a soul or a spirit, if you prefer. Comes to much the same thing in this understanding. Excuse me. But the truth, say Buddhists, is that it's never a reality. It's something we create from our mistaken behavior as very small children. And which we then, because when we do this, we create subconscious habit patterns as a result. And then these habit patterns more or less force us to move in the same direction continually right throughout our lives. That is, we'll always be moving towards the things that delight us rather than the things we need. There's certain things we want, but there are things that we need. That's what we should be interested in. But it's always the other way around with us. Nobody buys food that they need much. Some people do, but it's rare. We'd rather have McDonald's than something which is good for us, or a pizza or something like that, or some delicious fried food, which is not good for anybody, but is excessively delicious. Anybody who stays any length of time in Thailand knows what the food is like. It's probably the most delicious there is, and so many different varieties of it, it's ridiculous. I still get food, even now, after walking for hours for more than 12 years, every day practically, I still get food. Which I've never had before, never seen before. You still occasionally get a curry I've never seen before, never tasted before. Thai food is like this. It's kind of odd that Thais are Buddhists, really. Obviously not the sort of Buddhist that Buddhadasa was. So when you get the food reflection, you know, reflect on this at the same time, because it's the same thing. You delight in your food, you create the you who eats it. And then birth, aging, sickness and death are yours. All the forms of dukkha come home to roost. You're the one who's living life, you're the one who has to experience these things. Our problem is that we think there's always a me, so we always have this kind of stuff with us. You get used to it, you think life can't be any different. But you can, simply by denying this, not allowing this process to happen, that is, not allowing the mind to delight in things, or simply observing what you're doing when you do it. Like when you eat, just eat and observe the process of eating. Don't let the mind get stimulated by the flavor or texture of the food. In no long time, if you can do this and do it fairly regularly, you will notice that you start to feel very different mentally. You certainly become less selfish, your mind clears up, the meditation becomes easier, life becomes a little different for you. You begin to experience in a much clearer way. You start to see things more clearly, and then you start to think about the way you behave and the way you spend your money more clearly. You aren't so easily duped by the consumer system. We'll go on with this tomorrow, because there's some more to be said about anatta, of course. Rebirth and stuff like that, we need to touch on that. We also need to understand just what rebirth is in the mental sense. There's a physical version of rebirth from life to life, which is not really what we're about, but we'll look at it for sure. But more importantly, from a Siwamok point of view, there's rebirth from moment to moment of the ego sense in the human mind, independence on the desire for stimulation. You can look at that, because that is something you can understand and control quite easily. Rebirth from life to life always has a little mysticism about it. It's also a little vague. There's no clear explanation about how it happens, how it actually takes place and stuff like that. There's a little faith required, a little blind faith with that kind of thing. Buddhadasa would say a lot of blind faith. So have a nice day.